The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
This morning, I thought of talking about looking at ways that we, or our various kinds of identities, how we navigate the world with various identities, and to not neglect or to have some kind of a sense that identities are a problem or in the way, but that actually the exploration of being aware of identities is a part of our practice. It is a piece of opening up to who we are in this moment. One ancient Zen master, Dogen, said, "To study the way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. And to forget the self is to be awakened by all things." And so, you know, the sense of studying the self, not thinking, oh, I'm going to study the self so the self will disappear or the self will somehow magically go poof or be transcended. But, I mean, it will. There is a transformation that happens as we study the self, but we can't go in with the idea of I'm going to study this pattern or whatever it is. I mean, often we have, as we practice mindfulness and get to see the senses of selves we have, and I want to put that out there right away too. It's not just to study the self. The sense of self. We may think that there's one sense of self operating, you know, the one who's experiencing everything. But as we start to look at our experience, we see there's many senses of selves, many senses of who I am that vary depending on the relationships that I'm in, that vary depending on the situation. You know, I'm a very different person when I'm at home visiting my parents than I am when I'm walking around the grocery store. You know, there's a different sense of, you know, there can be some different sense of who I am in those different situations. And we can start to see this. And so studying those patterns, studying the senses of how we're identifying, what identifications or what patterns or strategies are we navigating the world with in this moment? As we study that, there with that kind of tension I was talking about in the guided meditation, that kind of tension brings a kind of somebody yesterday or a couple days ago I was talking to used the word enzyme, you know, that enzymes in our system digest things and transform. You know, we eat our food and those enzymes in our body are responsible for changing that food into something else that makes it useful. To make it the energy in that available. And I think of the kind of tension as that very kind of thing. Whatever it meets, it transforms into something useful for our system. When we turn to things with that kind of tension, it's like that kind of tension is an enzyme that allows whatever is known to be transformed into something useful for our waking up. And so the looking at our identities, looking at our strategies of how we navigate the world, bringing a kind attention to that, supports our waking up. And this is what Dogen was pointing to study the way is to study the self. To study it, to be interested in it, to be curious about it, not with the idea of I need to get rid of it or I need to fix it or change it. But to be curious about it, the very curiosity, that kind of tension which allows curiosity, creates the conditions in which things kind of more naturally begin to shift and change, and the understandings, the wisdom grows through that contact, just like the enzyme. You know, the enzymes contact the food and transform it into something that the body can process. And likewise, the mindfulness transforms the experiences that we have into something that can be understood, known, and that will support a process of waking up, a process of freedom. So I want to just reflect on the lens of our experience through how we identify, you know, what our identifications are. We can reflect on our experience through many different lenses, and so this is just the kind of lens I picked for this morning. I think many of the identities we have, I mean, so for instance, you know, just for myself, you know, I've got many identities that some of which are, you know, kind of, you know, personal, related to individuals, related to my personal conditioning, to my habits, the ways that I was, shaped as I grew up, the interactions I had on the playground, the way I was interacted with by my teachers in the classroom. You know, one identity, here's one that I just remembered as I was saying all this. And one identity that I have is like, you know, when I go into some kind of a situation where there's a presenter and there are chairs out there, I tend to sit in the front row. My identity about that, the inner experience of that is something along the lines of, I'm a really curious and interested person, and I like to be right up there so I can really see what's going on. Well, you know, when I think back on the shaping of that identity, it began when I was about 5 years old and my eyes started to fail. And, I didn't know my eyes were failing. But, you know, sitting in the front row allowed me to be able to see the blackboard. And I think, in fact, the teachers began to realize I couldn't see. So they would put me in the front row. So I got very comfortable in the front row because that's where I always was. And then, you know, it's like, well, then I got glasses, but then I was so comfortable in the front row, it's like, this is where I am. This is who I am. Why do I sit in the front row? Because I'm interested. You know, it's like, it was a construction. You know, it's just so, you know, there are ways that we're shaped by conditions. That's just one example. Different ways that we're shaped by, you know, familial relationships and, you know, patterns that repeat themselves, ways that our parents interacted with us tend to get repeated in our intimate relationships. I had, you know, examples of this in my history around relationships and various, you know, patterns and conflicts that I could see. You know, everybody says it, you know, oh yes, we're repeating the patterns of our childhood. But I had very little skill before I met the Dharma in terms of changing those patterns. I felt very caught by those patterns. They seemed so me. This is who I am. I have to be this way. And that person has to understand that I'm this way. And if they don't understand that I'm this way, I need to change them so that they can support that sense of identity. So, you know, these senses of identity are pervasive. And we have so many different identities. I had identities around, you know, and identities can arise around particular situations, too. You know, one person treats you in a certain way, and a kind of a self-righteous identity is born. You know, I don't deserve to be treated that way. Or perhaps a victim identity is born. I'm always treated this way. I must deserve this. So many different ways that identities arise. And as we begin to explore identities in our mindfulness, as we with our practice, we begin to see the many different ways, the many different kinds of identities we have, we might start to recognize, and this is just a kind of a sense I have, that our identities are strategies for navigating the world. Thanissaro Bhikkhu, a monk who does a lot of study of the texts and writing kind of modern-day commentaries about the Buddhist understandings. He talks about the strategies of selves, and that, you know, those strategies, the strategies that we have to navigate the world, largely in response to the unreliable, impermanent, uncontrollable nature of the world, that we find our way through various strategies. And so some of these identities are born as strategies for safety. You know, how can I be safe in this world? So looking at your identities, you know, there's often a thread back to some kind of need for safety. I think there's the various pieces. A need for safety is one kind of really core piece. And this is, you know, it's a very natural part of our organism that it wants to be safe. You know, it's not like it's a problem. And yet the strategies that come in around that kind of clamp down and create tightness and tension around that. Another kind of core strategy is wanting to be seen. You know, we want to be reflected. We want to be belong. Belonging is another area around which identities can form. You know, how can I belong? So safety is one. Belonging is one. There are probably many others. You know, that we kind of orient around some core kind of human. Almost wishes or desires. You know, the wish to be safe, the wish to be happy, the wish to be healthy, the wish to be able to take care of ourselves with ease. Now, this is a very natural part of our system that is basically a manifestation of loving kindness towards ourselves. And so our strategies kind of come in and try to, like, you know, make sure those happen. And so the strategies for self are not our enemy, actually. They have supported us in our lives. They have done the best that they could for us as we've lived. I think our organism, you know, the organism wants to be safe. It wants to have a sense of well-being. And so the mind and body do the best they can to navigate the world. And we can kind of look at our history and see that, yeah, I was teased a lot on the playground. You know, here are some strategies that arose around that. I became kind of introverted, alone, very happy to be alone in that. You know, it's like, well, if I can't have friends, I guess I'll be alone. I mean, that was the strategy that this mind found. And it worked for, you know. I mean, it wasn't that I was happy all the time being alone. I was a lot of times feeling like I was alone not out of choice, but because other people didn't want me. But at the same time, I learned ways to be alone. So, you know, so the strategies that we use are often connected to these very, you know, human wishes. These very natural wishes for our well-being. With meditation, we can sometimes start to see certain strategies that have formed through our lives as problematic. You know, we see that we're kind of stuck in old ways that we related to families or, you know, friends based on old patterns and conditioning. And we want to change it. I mean, I certainly had that sense. I didn't want to be the lonely, miserable, just the lonely, miserable person. And yet, you know, the mind was kind of caught in that identity and didn't know quite what to do with it. I wanted to get rid of it. And as I started watching in meditation, you know, and that can happen in meditation, you know, we see, wow, this is problematic. It's not needed anymore. You know, this is an old pattern. This is not needed today. I can see that the way that I'm reacting in the world here is related to all of that history, and it's not needed now. So I see that. Why can't I just flip a switch and, like, stop doing that? Partly we can't just flip the switch because those strategies have been conditioned over many, many years. So the studying of those strategies, again, that enzyme is what allows something different to happen. So we have different relationships with identities. We may want to get rid of them, like in this case, you know, wanting to get rid of my miserable identity, but having no idea how to do that. Or we think they are necessary. And sometimes they can be the same, you know. It's like we may, you know, want to get rid of an identity, but somehow feel like, but it's who I am. And so we kind of think it's a necessary part of us. So we're holding to it at the same time we think, but it makes me miserable. But sometimes we have senses of identity that... you know, we feel like are helpful for us. You know, my identity is being interested in what's happening, you know, interested in presentations. That identity of being intelligent and capable and all of those things. You know, the positive side of myself. I mean, I had these two baskets. One side that was like, yeah, I'm pretty capable, and I'm pretty, you know, I can pick things up, and I can, you know, do well when I study and that kind of thing. That was an identity. And then the other side is something along the lines of, but I'm really miserable. You know, I don't have any friends. I don't know how to make friends. I don't know, you know. So you know, we have these different identities. Some of which we think are helpful and useful, and some of which we think are problematic. And our normal kind of strategy would be seeing the ones that are problematic, we need to get rid of those, and seeing the ones that are helpful, we need to strengthen those. We need to hold on to those, make those more. So it's like we want to, like, divide our system and say, okay, these we take the scalpel to, we cut them out, we just, like, chuck them. And these we hang on to. So we've got this notion of, you know, what identities we want to have. And yet there's a middle way. And that is, again, to understand these identities, all of them, with that enzyme of wise attention. The great thing about that enzyme of wise attention, that transforming power of wise attention, is that it will digest and transform the strategies that get us caught and make us kind of miserable. It will transform those through the recognition of, so for instance, meeting miserableness, you know, meeting that miserableness, being mindful of miserableness, not with the idea of I need to get rid of this or fix it or change it, but just like, wow, miserableness is arising. That's interesting. What's happening? That kind attention. Well, this is arising. Let's see what's happening around that. that enzyme of mindfulness begins to help the system, the organism, begin to recognize, you know, what parts of that identity, what parts of that sense of self are not helpful. You know, the part that somehow I can't make friends, I'm inherently somehow different or something like that. That stuff gets transformed into recognizing, wow, that's actually, first of all, it's not useful, and even more deeply, it's often not true. And yet there's a piece of that pattern. You know, the wish to be loved, the wish to belong, that deeper sense of kindness towards ourself, that enzyme doesn't get rid of, but actually strengthens. And so there's an interesting pattern that as we turn with kind attention to those difficult patterns, those difficult identities, that the enzyme kind of allows the parts that are stuck, that are tight, that are creating suffering for ourselves, it allows those to begin to be transformed into, and sometimes melt away. It's almost like they just begin to be seen for non-supportive, non-helpful strategies. And yet the part that wants to be seen, that wants to be loved, that basic wish for love, that enzyme understands, wow, that's a wholesome wish. And so it doesn't actually dissolve that and get rid of it. It transforms it and strengthens it with a new orientation. That wish to be loved and belong can have a positive and a wholesome manifestation in our experience. And then likewise, if we turn our attention to those strategies that we think are, you know, like, oh, I'm the person who's really interested and I'm good at things. You know, so we turn our attention to those strategies. Again, the enzyme begins to recognize and understand what parts of that strategy are helpful and supportive for an organism and a being, and what parts of it are actually in the way. So the parts of the mind that are curious and interested and explorative and discerning, those don't go away with that enzyme. In fact, those get strengthened. But the sense of I am this person, the sense of, you know, there's a kind of contraction that happens when we pick something up and say, this is who I am. That contraction, that need to be that person, that need to have the world think I'm that person, that's a big part of identification too, especially those ones that we like. It's like we like those identities. We want to see ourselves that way, and we sure want the world to see us that way. So that whole pattern of making sure we're continually seeing ourselves that way and the work that we do to try to make other people see ourselves that way, it's exhausting and it's unnecessary. That strategy is born out of a misunderstanding, basically. So we begin to explore this middle way, this enzyme of wise attention, of kind attention, to all of our identities. And my sense is that what happens is that in all of those identities, that wise attention begins to discern what parts of the pattern are helpful and supportive and what parts of the pattern are not helpful. And most, if not all, of our identities have both. So to have the idea that these we need to get rid of and these we need to keep isn't quite the nuanced approach that wise attention brings. Now, it is challenging. I have to say it's not easy to allow a kind attention with all of our patterns. Because, you know, we have to be really honest with ourselves. Those patterns of contraction and the patterns we don't like that we don't want to get rid of, we have to acknowledge, yeah, there are pieces of those that are very deep and very profound. The wish to be loved, the wish to be belong, and that those are not to be gotten rid of so much, but to be understood in a new way. And it also takes courage and honesty to face those patterns because they create so much tension and tightness and contraction in the mind. It's painful sometimes to watch them. You know, the very act of being mindful of miserableness, the very act of being mindful of self-hatred doesn't feel good. You know, it's not like... In fact, the very, you know, being aware of how painful it is to hold those identities is part of the enzyme at work. It's part of the learning that happens, the part of the way the mind begins to understand what parts are helpful in this pattern and what parts are not helpful. And so it takes courage. It takes courage to meet all of our patterns. So one thing I want to say, I want to give some examples, but before I want to give some examples from my own experience so that you can get a sense of how this process can work, this transformation, how this enzyme can work around looking at identities, and that it can work. I mean, I think partly why I like to tell my own stories is to inspire a sense of confidence that, yeah, this actually can be done. We can turn towards really difficult patterns and have a transformation happen, an understanding happen that shifts our relationship to those identities. But I want to first say that, you know, I'm talking from this lens of identities today. You know, how do we identify? I am this, I am that. This is, you know, this is who I am. These things are mine. So, you know, this kind of identification process that happens in the mind. But the teachings of the Buddha, the Buddhist teachings, talk about the process of identification. It actually describes how identification happens. It gives us, like, you know, set of steps that happens in our minds by which we pick something up and say, oh yes, that's me, that's mine, that's who I am. And one of the things that's interesting about that process of the creation of identities is that it's exactly the same process that describes the creation of suffering. The very same set of steps that create suffering creates a sense of identity. And so, you know, we can look at this whole picture through the lens of where am I suffering? You know, where is there pain? Where is there a sense of not rightness, of offness? Sometimes that's what's most obvious in our experience. Ah, doesn't feel right, doesn't feel good. We may not in a moment have a clear sense of the identity that's under there, that is associated with that sense of offness. There is an identity related to it. There's always an identity associated with suffering. Sometimes the identity is obvious. Sometimes it's not. And so we don't have to, you know, in this study, the study of selfing, the study of identity, we don't always have to find what the identity is. If suffering is what's obvious, study the suffering. You're already studying the same process. It's just like a different perspective on the very same phenomenon. So if suffering is what's obvious, can you use that kind attention to allow something to happen around that suffering, that enzyme to digest and transform suffering. And sometimes in that process, we begin to see beliefs, attitudes, opinions, identities that are associated with that. Sometimes we actually begin to recognize the identities that are associated with our suffering. Sometimes not. Sometimes the transformation happens directly through suffering. Sometimes the sense of identity, we were talking about this at a retreat recently, and somebody described the feeling of identity. We were at Spirit Rock, and Spirit Rock has wild turkeys everywhere, and you know, the turkeys wander around, and then every now and then, particularly the male turkeys will go, you know, they puff up and they, you know, their tails go and it's often when they're around the female turkeys, you know, they will puff up and it's like they're trying to present themselves in a certain way. That and sometimes they'll just do it randomly, you know. You sometimes see an individual turkey on the hillside go, it's kind of like, that's interesting, you know. And we do something similar. The sense of self often has that feeling of kind of puffed up or full. I mean, the language full of ourselves, you know, I think is an expression of that feeling of puffed up. So sometimes that feeling is very clear. And we can start to get familiar with that, ooh, puffed up feeling. It's like, ooh, there's one. Let's look at that. Let's let that enzyme of wise attention. Ooh, what's that? That's curious. Let's play. Let's explore that. So curiosity about either suffering or about the senses of identity, that's a big piece of the enzyme of wise attention. If we can have that relationship of curiosity instead of another enzyme actually comes in to solidify and strengthen those identities and sufferings, and that is something along the lines of either this is how I have to be, or this I need to get rid of this, or I need to fix this or change this. Even paradoxically, this notion of I need to get rid of or fix or change tends to solidify those identities, tends to not create the conditions for that transformation to happen. So a few examples, because for me, as I thought about this, you know, that exploration of identities has happened so many different ways in my practice. It's not simply that there's one way that transformation happens around identities, or that digestion, that enzyme transforms, or, you know, pulls apart the pattern to create the, you know, to and, you know, very similarly to create the conditions for what that pattern is made of to be used in a new way, or to be dissolved and passed away. So the first story, I'll see how many I can get through. I'll just tell a few and try to leave about 10 minutes for discussion here at the end. One pattern I had was a pattern of identification of self-righteousness and anger with a particular person. This was a pattern that began my practice. It was like one of the very first patterns that I worked with. There was a lot of suffering around it. And what I began to recognize, so that pattern would come up, the sense of self-righteousness, the sense of that person should not have done that to me. You know, so that feeling of identification around somebody doing something to me and things that I thought of that, you know, should happen to that person as a result. You know, so like kind of a revenge mentality happening. And lots of anger coming up. And so what I began to see, and this is I think important in exploring this enzyme of wise attention, what I began to see is that when I tried to bring mindfulness to that pattern, it's like, okay, I see that coming up. It's like, I feel it. When I say, okay, let me be mindful of all of this, you know, all the stuff in the body, what's happening in the mind. over and over again, I would get caught by that pattern. The attempt to bring mindfulness to the pattern, just, you know, like I got lost in the quicksand. I got dragged down the rabbit hole of that pattern over and over and over again. And at some point, I recognized, okay, the trying to be mindful of that is not helpful, is not working. And so I'm going to notice when it happens. There it is. And it's kind of like I bowed to it. It's like, I see you. And I actually made a bargain with it. I said, you know, I'll practice with you when my mindfulness gets stronger. Mindfulness isn't strong enough right now to meet you, you know, meet this pattern. And you can stay here in the room with me. I'm not going to like try to kick you out or like repress you or get rid of you. You can stay here in the room with me, but I'm not going to pay attention to you. I'm going to like pay attention to my feet. I'm going to walk. We're going to take a walk, and I'm going to just watch my feet. And so over and over again, that enzyme of wise attention, just let that pattern be. It's kind of a let be. It wasn't a turn to. It wasn't a like pick it up, put it under the microscope. It wasn't a try to figure out all the patterns and processes that were at play. But I let the wise attention pick up something else and let that pattern of self-righteousness and anger and the identification with that just sit to the side. And in that process, there was a kind of a long process. I did that probably for a couple of years. So it was a long enzyme digestion thing that happened. But in the course of that time, the pattern itself began to shift. And in fact, it went away without my ever looking at it. At one point, I kind of woke up and it's like, wow, that pattern hasn't happened in a long time. You know, I would notice it every time it happened. It's like, yep, there it is again. Okay, we'll take a walk. It's like over and over again. That was the way the enzyme worked with that particular pattern. Oh, there you are. Let's take a walk. At one point, I noticed, wow, that hasn't happened in a long time. And even the memory of it, even the memory of that pattern, you know, brought the person into my mind, it brought the whole situation into my mind, even that didn't have the power to reconstruct that identity of self-righteousness and anger at that person. And it's like, wow, it's gone. And it has not rearisen since then. It is gone. So that's one thing I wanted to point to, that sometimes, you know, we sometimes have the notion of, oh, you know, to study the way is to study the self. To study the self means, whoo, put it under a microscope, figure it out, pick it apart. Sometimes studying the self is meet it and set it aside. Meet it and set it aside. Meet it and set it aside over and over again, not repressing it and not buying into it. And that can also have a very powerful transformative effect. So that's one way an identity transformed for me, by being willing to not neither dive in or repress, but just to kind of allow a very gentle, like almost behind the scenes transformation, not engaging with it, but not repressing it. Then there was another side, another pattern of self-hatred that I did do. I did have more of an opportunity. There was a time when I was on a retreat and the pattern of self-hatred got very apparent in my mind. Small things would happen. I'd leave a note for a teacher or I'd say something in an interview and self-hatred would come in. You know, so it was just being activated. I began to recognize, oh, I can actually explore this. Now, there were times when I had to set it aside, much as the anger, times when the power of the self-hatred was stronger than the mindfulness. And setting it aside was appropriate. I think that's one important tool for us to recognize with this practice of wise attention. When can our wise attention meet the pattern? And when is it overwhelmed by the pattern? If it's overwhelmed, that's not the time to try to be mindful of it. Set it to the side and be attentive to something else. But I discovered on this particular retreat that there were times when I could be attentive to the pattern of self-hatred. A lot of psychological stuff was coming up. History and memories and emotions. And it's like, wow, there's a lot there. There's a lot there to be known and to be seen. And there was a lot of understanding that happened around the conditioning of that pattern. So that was a piece of the transformation. There was some like almost psychological understanding of that pattern. And a sense of, oh, I see how that pattern got put together. There was a power to that, you know, the identity of self-hatred, understanding that it was, you know, conditioned by psychology, by conditions, by patterns, you know, on the playground and, you know, just everywhere, you know, just the patterns of interaction through my life, that pattern had been conditioned. I'm unworthy. People don't like me. I'm unworthy. And hating myself because I was unworthy, you know. So that pattern got reinforced. And so seeing those pieces psychologically, there was a kind of a transformation around. It's like, oh, I understand why this is happening. It's not personal. It's not even my fault. You know, it's like, it's just what happened. You know, pretty much any being in those situations would have a similar response. And so that allowed a sense of, oh, this pattern is arising because of conditions. And with that, there was more of a capacity to watch the pattern. Actually, I was surprised because there was some really deep insights into the fact of, you know, the whole pattern of that. And there was a lot of release happening around, wow, I see how this works. And at some point I even thought, wow, I must be done with this pattern. And I was shocked because the psychological insights didn't actually prevent the self-hatred from arising. But what those psychological insights did do was to allow me to be more okay with seeing, oh, this is coming. This pattern, it's just self-hatred arising. Oh, it's a thought. There's a thought arising, and that thought is responded to in a particular way, and self-hatred arises. It allowed the mind to be able to watch the pattern as just process. Self-hatred's arising in the mind. Self-hatred is ceasing in the mind. Not related to all of the emotional and, you know, it became less psychological and more what we could call phenomenological, just about something's arising, something's passing away, and a capacity to meet that. And that also had a transformative effect, seeing the pattern as just a thought arising in the mind. That actually was the moment of real transformation around that pattern when there was a seeing with mindful attention. This pattern of self-hatred is nothing other than an arising thought that is believed. The mind could see the thought, it could see the belief kind of glom onto it. And in seeing that happen, there's a kind of a deep recognition, you know, this self-hatred is constructed in this moment. It's not like there's a bag of self-hatred I'm carrying around with me. There's a pattern of conditioning that's familiar that this mind tends to react because of that pattern of conditioning. This pattern of conditioning tends to construct self-hatred over and over again. And yet, the seeing that the mind is doing that construction, that's very powerful. When the organism understands it's creating its own suffering, it begins to understand how not to do that. And it understands that it's not helpful. So again, this enzyme, right through the meeting of even very painful identities, Transformation happens. And the last piece I'll say, there's a lot more I could offer in terms of ways to work with identities. These days, I would say one of the key or main tools that I explore, and it's like the sense of I use it both with a sense of suffering and with a sense of identity. You know, it's like whether the sense of suffering is what's obvious or a sense of I'm this person. Whichever is obvious, there's a kind of a, it's almost like there's a, that experience is a wake-up bell for the mind. It's like, oh, pay attention, something's happening, you know, be attentive to this. And the question that's interesting in that moment is, what's being believed right now? And maybe I don't know what's being believed. You know, sometimes that question can clearly, I can clearly recognize, oh, I believe I need to do something, or I believe I'm right, you know, whatever it is, you know, so that sometimes there can be a clear recognition of a belief. Sometimes not. But what I've seen has been actually pretty interesting is that even if I can't see what's being believed, it's like I can acknowledge something is being believed right now. I'm caught by a belief right now. And something about that acknowledgement, caught by a belief, it's like it doesn't make the belief go away, but it creates a container in which there's an okayness that I'm caught by that belief. And the entire experience has a different feeling. It's like, oh, I'm caught by a belief right now. That's all that's happening. It's like, okay, I'll be with that. Be with that. I'm caught by a belief. Not even knowing what the belief is. Sometimes that's a very powerful recognition. And so I think the exploration around beliefs and identities, there's a really strong correlation there. That the beliefs are very intimately connected to our identities. And so as we can begin to be curious about what we're believing, that enzyme can begin to work almost at a deeper level. So comments, questions, curiosities? Yeah.
Thanks for coming here.
I don't think it's on.
Yeah. Okay. Well, the main thing I thought was interesting is this, because I've lived almost 30 years in California. I lived about 10 years each in Texas, Ohio, and Pennsylvania. And I'm very aware that I developed a very different personality in each of those places. And more recently, I was worked in 2011 and 2012 as a substitute teacher. I was substitute teaching both in difficult schools in South San Jose, and I was substitute teaching in Mountain View high schools. And I developed these almost diametrically opposite personas in those two centers. I was the military Marine sergeant in South San Jose, and I was the sweet and mellow, affable substitute in Mountain View. It was just two different situations. And you just develop these things. And then sometimes something happens that somehow acts as a trigger that brings out an old part of yourself that you thought you'd forgotten. And sometimes it's a difficult situation. So, for example, if there's a family member that you have a difficulty with and then you confront them. And then sometimes I've found on at least one occasion triggers happen that have nothing to do with aversion or unpleasantness. It's just a reminder.
Uh-huh.
And the thing that was, I guess, striking to me is after spending elementary school in Texas, I spent my first year of junior high school in England. And then I worked very hard on losing my Texas accent. I worked very hard on developing a convincing English accent. I was not trying to sound English. I was trying to stop sounding like a Dallas cowboy.
Uh-huh.
Okay, and it worked. I pretty much lost the Texas accent that I'd grown up with. And that was in the late 60s. And in 2004, I was at the Graduate Theological Union, and I was taking a delightful class on African woman novelists, focused on Alice Walker and Toni Morrison. And I swear, during the class discussions in that class, I kept slipping back into that Texas cowboy accent that I hadn't used for 35 years. It just resurfaced. Mm-hmm. And it's always intrigued me. So, you know, all these old patterns they're floating around in the...
Yep, they are. The point that you make about triggers is really interesting. I think that's a point. I remember when I was, you know, when you can see triggers, you know, when you can see the phenomenon that's triggering a pattern, particularly an identity or an emotional reactivity, it's very powerful because we see in that moment, that pattern wasn't there a moment before. There was this event, and then it happened. And so we can see the creation right there in the mind. I remember at one point on a retreat, I walked down and towards my room, and I pushed open the door. And as I walked through the door, there was a flash of a memory of having walked through that door, you know, 5 days before. So there's an associative. Often those triggers have an associative nature. You know, I flashed on 5 days before having walked through that door when I was in such a state of bliss. 5 days before, I had been deeply, you know, really a lot of concentration, and that concentration was like riding me down the stairs into my room, and I was just like floating through that door 5 days earlier. I was not floating through the door that day. The memory of that created a sense of difference and a sense of, oh, I must not be doing it right. I'm not always floating through, you know, the door. And in a split second, there was this feeling, I'm failing. I'm a failure and unworthy and hating myself within a split second, you know. But I had seen that trigger. I had seen the trigger of that going through the door, the memory of 5 days before, leading to this pattern, this very familiar pattern of self-hatred. This was probably on my self-hatred retreat. I don't remember. Watch that whole thing unfold, and I could even go, oh, look at that, you know, kind of laughing at it. So seeing the triggers can be really powerful, seeing the triggers for a pattern arising. So that's a great point. We have a minute. Anybody else have anything they want to say? Okay. Thank you for your attention.